WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Jack Teagarden and Wingy Minone, a recording of Hoagy Carmichael's Rocking Chair, also featured on an album called Big T and Mighty Max, session of Commodore reissues, annotated by my guest Dan Morgenstern. Dan Morgenstern has been intimately involved with jazz for many years. He's now the director of the Institute of Jazz Studies of Rutgers University. He's also been an editor of Metronome magazine, Jazz magazine, and from 1967 to 73 he was the editor of Downbeat. Chances are you've read some of the many liner notes that he's written for jazz recordings. He's won 3 Grammys for his liner notes. Dan Morgenstern has also produced concerts and co-produced the Just Jazz series for public television, and he's the author of the book Jazz People, a collaboration with Danish photographer Ole Brask. Presently, he's at work on the Oxford Companion to Jazz, which is scheduled for publication sometime in the early 1980s. We're going to be talking about his work with music, and we'll also be listening to some of the records that he's brought with him from the Institute of Jazz Studies archives. Dan Morgenstern, a great pleasure to have you here this afternoon.
Thank you. It's nice to be here, Tammy.
Before we get to listening to some of the music that you've brought with you, I'd really like to hear a little bit about how you got interested in jazz, how you first started listening to it.
Well, having been born in Europe, specifically in Vienna, Austria, I was not really exposed to jazz at an early age the same way I would have been if I had grown up in the United States. But after we left Vienna, courtesy of Mr. Hitler in 1938, we moved to Denmark, and in my very early days in Copenhagen, which is a marvelous city, my mother took me to a Fats Waller concert. He was then doing he made only 2 visits to Europe, and this was the first one. And he was in England, but he made sort of a side trip to Denmark, and he was doing a single, I remember that he came out in a silver top hat and a white suit of tails, and he sat down at the piano and he started to play and sing. And even though at the time I was 8 years old and I didn't understand any English, I had a marvelous time, and it was just the presence of that man, I think, that drew me into jazz. And of course I had already started a little record collection, and I was then struggling with a violin, not very successfully. So I was into music, but I made my mother get me some Fats Waller records, and then I graduated to Ella Fitzgerald with Chick Webb, was very popular then, and that was the swing era, and by 1939 that had really filtered into Europe, and Scandinavia was always very jazz conscious. So I went to a boarding school, I was sent to a boarding school, and I had my little collection of jazz records, and because of that I became quite popular with the older kids, were in their mid and late teens, because they wanted these records primarily to dance to, so they took me along. No, that was the price they had to pay. And I must have been a terribly precocious and snotty little kid at that time. Anyway, my records, you know, really were the social entree. But I wasn't serious about jazz then, and that didn't happen until sometime later. And after the war, in 1946, the first American band to come to Denmark, was Don Redman's big band, one that had been put together especially for the occasion. And it had in it Don Byas. He was the real star of the band. And Peanuts Holland, a very good trumpet player who had been featured with Charlie Barnett and then settled in Europe. A very young Billy Taylor on piano. And Quentin Jackson was one of the trombones. Good band. And, of course, it was fantastic to see all that. And I think I went to every concert they gave, and then there were some jam sessions and so on. So that really got me hooked. And a year later, I arrived in the United States, and of course the first thing I wanted to do was to go to 52nd Street. And I was still underage, but not so much. I was 17, so I was able to sneak in. And I still got into the tail end of that, and the street... In retrospect, the street was dying then, but I didn't know that. To me, it was paradise, you know. And so I started, my parents, I was reunited with my father who had, that would make a long story, but he had to get away from Vienna before us because not only was he Jewish, but he also had written against the Nazis starting way back in the 20s, so... He was wanted, and he got into France, and then he made his way to Morocco and then to Portugal, and he arrived here in 41 before America got into the war. And then we were sort of cut off from each other, of course, since the Nazis had occupied Denmark. And so, but that's, you know, that's another story. That's for another program. In any case, on 52nd Street, where I was hanging out, much to the despair of my parents who wanted me to go to school, but I had knew enough about this country. I thought, you know, that that wasn't the way to do it. I had to go out and work and do something. Anyway, I was working, so I had a little spending money. And in those days, you could go into a club in 52nd Street and nurse a beer, which cost all of 75 cents. Through a couple of sets, at least, by edging sort of away from the bartender and staying at the edge of the crowd around the bar. And they really didn't mind as long as you behaved yourself. So you could stretch that for a couple of sets in one club and then go to another and so on. And I became friendly with some of the musicians. I think the first musician who really was nice to me was Art Hodes, piano player, who was then working at Jimmy Ryan's. And then I met a little trumpet player who never made a name for himself. He was known as Face, and his real name is Nat Lorber. But he was a protege of Hot Lips Page, and through him I got to know Lips, who was a fantastic trumpet player, singer, one of the greatest blues singers ever, and a marvelous, warm, vital person who didn't mind my tagging along. Lips was one of the world's great jammers. He was always ready to keep on playing after the regular jobs ended. So he would go uptown with a bunch of friends, would pile into a cab, and go up to Harlem. And he knew all the scenes up there, everything from Hole in the Wall, which would be like an after-hours pad where there would be a beat-up piano in the kitchen and people would be sitting around drinking beer or straight shots of whiskey or whatever, and two very elaborate after-hours clubs, which were actually indistinguishable from regular legitimate nightclubs and had a bandstand and would hire a band to play. And these other places, people would just fall in and unwrap their horns and somebody would sing or whatever. And through this, I feel extremely fortunate that my introduction to the music or to the jazz life came about in this manner. I didn't know it then. As I said before, this was, in a sense, the end of an era, but it was still very much alive. And I sort of identified with the musicians, and I wanted, my violin had been on the shelf for a while, and that wasn't really the right instrument anyway. If you can't play the violin really well, it sounds awful. It's not one of those instruments where you can get by just, you know, playing a little bit. And anyway, I'd become fascinated with the trumpet, so I wanted to get a trumpet and take lessons. But then I was drafted, and ironically sent to Europe, where I was stationed at something called the Munich Military Post Service Center, which had been the Dachau concentration camp, and we lived in what were had been the SS barracks. So that was kind of a weird way to come back to Europe much sooner than I had intended or wanted to. But on the other hand, they could have sent me to Korea, so I was lucky. And then when I came back, I decided to go back to college. And then that was where I first got involved in writing, because I became editor of the school paper. I was at Brandeis University, which was an interesting place to be then. And there, in order to promote some concerts that we were putting on, Storyville was in Boston then, and that was George Wein's club. This was before the first Newport Jazz Festival. And he had Art Tatum there, so we decided that let's try to get Tatum to come up to Brandeis and do a concert. He was off on Saturday afternoon. Sunday afternoon they played at the club. So we got in touch with George, and he talked to Art and said okay, and he came out. We had the best piano in the place, you know, just tuned for him and so on, and he gave a marvelous solo recital. And then he told us afterwards that this was one of the very few times that he had done anything like that. He loved to play solo concerts, but he almost never got a chance to do so. So that made us feel almost embarrassed, but it, you know, it was a marvelous concert. So in order to plug that, I wrote something about Tatum. And then we brought Nat Hentoff, who was then still in Boston, to lecture on campus, and he said to me, he said, why don't you, you seem to know a lot about this stuff, why don't you write about it? So I didn't, I had other things on my mind. I wrote a few pieces in the paper, but then I was interested in journalism, and I went to work for the New York Post and wound up in the drama department, meaning also music, film, you know, the whole thing. And had very little opportunity to write anything decent once I reviewed a Randall's Island Jazz Festival. But Dorothy Schiff, who ran the Post, did not like jazz, and even though some of the editors did, we never got anything in there aside from that one review. But then I'd been asked by Stanley Dance, the noted jazz writer, who was then still living in England but was here on a visit, and who kept running into me at recording sessions and stuff. I used to go because the musicians would tell me about it and say, come on. And it was always very interesting. So he suggested to me that I write for Jazz Journal, a British magazine, who needed a New York correspondent. They had lost their man here. And Stanley warned me. He said, it won't pay anything. They'll pay you off in books and records sometimes. But it might be fun to do. So I started sending them a monthly column, and they liked it, and so did other people. And then I was asked to write for Downbeat and for some other American magazines. And all of a sudden, I found myself in a position where I was still at the Post and not too happy there, and I was offered a job as associate editor of Metronome, which was really not in very good shape. And I knew that it wasn't in good shape, but here was a chance, first of all, to have a job which was good from the standpoint of practical experience, and also to be involved full-time in jazz. So I took it, and the magazine lasted about a year. I wound up with the dubious distinction of being its last editor, but it didn't die because of anything that we did or didn't do. It was just in too bad financial shape at that point. But then I was bitten by the bug, and from then on I've continued to make my living in jazz, or make jazz my life, whichever way you want to put it. And it's something that I haven't regretted. I've been very lucky. It's not easy to do that. One finds that the only way, really, to make a living as a jazz writer is to have an editorial position on a publication, and there are very few publications that have full-time editorial staffs. So, again, I've been lucky, and now that I'm out of the magazine world, I'm also quite pleased with that, because what I'm doing now gives me a chance to both help people in the field on a variety of levels, and also to build the archives at Rutgers, at the Institute of Jazz Studies, into something which I think already is, but is far from where it should be as the largest and best collection of jazz materials for public use anywhere.
Well, listen, since you were talking a little bit about Hot Lips Page before, let's listen to one of the records you've brought with you from the Institute of Jazz Studies archives. You were telling us a little bit about how you used to hang around with him, how he was one of the first people who you used to go to clubs with in New York.
Well, I said that Lips was an inveterate jam session player, and what we have here is something that I never thought would make its way to records, but this is not a bootleg, it's a legitimate release. And there was a man named Jerry Newman, he's dead now, who in the early 40s was a student at Columbia University and a jazz fan, and he had portable recording equipment. And the musicians trusted him and liked him, and they got a kick out of these on-the-spot recordings that he would do. So he had entree to a lot of places and brought his equipment with him and recorded these things primarily for his own enjoyment. And then some of them came out during his lifetime, notably the Charlie Christian stuff from Minton's, which, of course, is the only documentation of that legendary place where bebop was born, or so they say. But he also used to run parties at his parents' big apartment on Fifth Avenue when they were away. And at one of those parties, he had Donald Lambert, who's a legendary pianist, born in Princeton, New Jersey, made very few records, a contemporary of James P. Johnson's and Fats Waller. And a tenor player named Herbie Fields, who was not the world's greatest tenor player, but was Jerry Newman's sidekick and the guy who really got him turned on to jazz, so we have to be charitable to Herbie. And Lips Page, who here is playing at a party, and you can hear it's a party, and because they didn't want to, the trumpet is a very commanding instrument, especially the way Lips played it, and they didn't want to shake the walls down, so he's got his leather trumpet case over the bell of the horn, which gives a kind of a unique sound, and they're jamming on a standard which probably is played as much in jazz as anything aside from the blues, and it's called I Got Rhythm. I'm
Hot Lips Page, Jammin' and I Got Rhythm, from an album that has been brought to the station by my guest Dan Morgenstern, who's joining us this afternoon from the Institute of Jazz Studies of Rutgers University, where he is the director of the program. We were talking a little bit before, Dan Morgenstern, about how you developed your taste in jazz, how you started listening to it. For many years now, you've had to listen not only as someone who's enthusiastic about the music, but as someone who has to make judgments and evaluations on the music and pass on those judgments and evaluations to the people who read you. Have there been times when you have really changed your mind about someone's music, where your first exposure to them has made you feel one way, either positive or negative, about their playing, and through repeated exposure to them, your reaction has completely changed?
Well, the latter part of the question, completely changed. I can't think of any instance like that, frankly. Sometimes first impressions are, not the right ones. But I can honestly say, for instance, that when I first heard Ornette Coleman on record, I was not impressed. And I think what I heard was a track called The Sphinx from his first album on Contemporary. Needless to say, that was not representative Ornette. But when he came to New York and played at the Five Spot, I went down there with some trepidation because what I'd heard I hadn't liked that much. And then there was already a lot of controversy about Ornette. And I went in there and I liked it. I mean, I didn't think that it was a message from the Messiah. It didn't strike me as that. As a matter of fact, I was surprised at how easily accessible it was, because it seemed to me like just an extension of bebop, which essentially is what it was. And Ornette to me sounded like somebody who knew and loved Charlie Parker, which he did and does, and they were obviously playing together. So I didn't go all the way like, say, Martin Williams, who at that time was really, saying that Ornette was. And he was right, because he realized how important that music was. I didn't realize that, but I liked it, and I came to know Ornette, and we became quite friendly. And he had a rough time then because of the reaction to his music. He just wanted to play his music. That was the first chance he really had to play it. But everybody pounced on it, and it became a political football. And I think that conditioned Ornette's thinking in many ways, the way he is now. He's a little strange in the way he feels about himself and about the music world and so on. And he has, in a sense, shut himself off, unfortunately, from a lot of playing opportunities. But I can understand why he feels that way, because it's the same reason, in a way, why Ralph Ellison isn't writing any books. You know.
What relationship have you tried to have with jazz musicians? Because, sometimes when you're writing about people's music, I know some people would prefer, when they're in that position, to not have friendly relationships with the people they're writing about, because it could, one, really affect the way you view someone's music. It can really affect your critical perceptions. Secondly, if you don't like someone's performance and you want to write it, you could feel terribly bad if you're very close to this person, having to knock their music in your column or wherever you're writing.
It's a problem which is not peculiar to jazz, although in jazz it exists perhaps in a even more immediate way. But all critics have this problem. I'm sure the theater critic of an important daily newspaper, who knows that his review affects the fate of literally hundreds of people, because it's not only the cast but all the people backstage and everybody who is involved in it and so on. It has a terrible responsibility, and very often he will know and even personally like many of the people involved in this thing, but he has to maintain his objectivity. I think the main thing is to be fair, and that's what I have against a lot of criticism, not only in jazz but everywhere, is when it becomes unfair. Fair criticism, even if it's negative, is all right, but unfair criticism is not. And I think in terms of your own personal relationship with the musicians, well, again, I was preconditioned. I came into this music as a fan and as a bystander and as a friend of the musicians, who is very grateful for having been accepted by them. I was at a time when I was a kid, and they let me come along. They took me seriously, they talked to me, they let me in on a lot of things about how they felt, about the music, about life in general, and so on. And that was under the heading, in a sense, of privileged communication. Later on, when I became a professional, I didn't violate this, and I think that's one of the things that I made very sure not to do, because it would have been unfair. If I had used something that I knew about an artist against him, or not even against, but in a way that would have revealed something which he didn't mean to have revealed, I had their confidence, and I still do, I think, because I haven't violated it. And I couldn't help myself. I mean, once I become part of that world, I will admit it, as a group of people, I'm very fond of jazz musicians. I wouldn't have stayed in this field if it hadn't been for the very satisfying human element of it. Now, I have colleagues who claim that it's bad to know the artists too well. And sometimes, maybe, I don't think it's bad if someone you know and like is an inferior player. I mean, then you have some troubles to face. But I don't think that's ever really become a problem to me. Because if I try to avoid situations where there really is something that you might call a conflict of interest, I can, I don't have to review a performance by someone whom I feel, too closely involved with. I wouldn't, for instance, be someone's manager and also write about them, which some of my colleagues at various times have done, and which I don't believe is right. It's not fair to the public, and it's not fair to the artist, and not fair to yourself. But by and large, I've been able to avoid any serious conflicts. It's not anything that has that really rests on my, on my psyche. It's been fine because I can write honestly about somebody and they will accept it. It has never happened to me that a musician has resented something I've said, even if it has not been positive, because he knew that I was telling the truth.
I'd briefly like to hear your reactions to this. I know a lot of jazz musicians resent a lot of critics, because they feel that the critics have misrepresented them, misunderstood changes in the music that have later been recognized as important breakthroughs within the music. Now, every art form has a school of criticism that, looks at this art, tries to interpret it, evaluate it, discuss it, describe it, and that's always been a very important and accepted part of any art form. And within jazz, it seems to be very frequently resented by the people who create the art. And I feel that perhaps, on the other hand, if there weren't the writers who were so intimately involved with the music and felt it was that important, that they wanted to write about it all the time and they wanted to use language to communicate things about the music, that the jazz musicians would have every right to say, well, this is really important. There should be critics. should be people writing about this music, right?
You'll find very few artists in any field who are firm believers in or fans of criticism. Criticism in general tends to be resented by the artist because he or she feels that it's an intensely, it seems redundant or even superfluous to say that it's a personal thing. I mean, it's the most immediate expression of the self that you can imagine. An artist lays it on the line no matter what he does. I mean, they're naked out there. So it becomes a very sensitive issue to have someone picking at your innards, so to speak. On the other hand, all artists want publicity. The ideal critic for any artist is a publicist, someone who says nothing but great things about them, keeps their name in front of the public, and helps them in their career. Now, but that's not criticism, although critics, of course, can and have done, have performed precisely that function for someone they really believed in. So it's kind of a dilemma. The two worlds are parallel, but they seldom meet. The musicians realize that there is a need for it, but they resent it when it isn't positive, and sometimes rightly so, because, well, jazz, again, is a special case. There aren't exactly hundreds of jobs around for theater critics or film critics, but nevertheless, it is a field. Jazz criticism, although there are many people who practice it, is not really a field. That is to say, it's not a field in which you can make a living, not consistently. You can make a living if you're on the staff of a full-time publication. The only magazine like that in this country really is Downbeat. All the others, regardless of how professional some of them may look, do not provide a full-time living for anyone involved in them, except maybe the publisher, if he's very brave or foolhardy. So you can write for magazines and newspapers and more or less pick up pennies. You can spread yourself out in other things and become you write liner notes. You may do broadcasting. You may become a concert promoter, a producer. You may get involved. Many people have entered the music with nothing specific in mind other than that they liked it and wanted to become involved in it. George Wein originally started out as a musician, and then he started lecturing on the music with demonstrations, and he taught a course up in Boston. He was one of the first to teach a jazz course. He wrote a column for a Boston newspaper. He had no idea that he would become the world's foremost jazz producer, but it happened. He opened a club, and from the club came concerts, and then came the Newport Festival, and that was it. For many of us, things have happened in a kind of unpredictable way. The only person I know who has been a lifetime, full-time jazz critic, but also, of course, has produced concerts and records and other things, is Leonard Feather. Leonard has really managed to do that, and I have great respect for him on that account. But Leonard also has been around so long that you get another thing that happens with musicians. When Leonard first came to this country, 1935, from England, he was a bright young man who was writing for Melody Maker, which was an important English music paper, and then soon started to write here and so on. A lot of musicians befriended him, and like all of us, he was also a fan. So he made friendships, and there were musicians whom he boosted and furthered and so on. Then times changed, and Leonard became involved in bebop. He was one of the great boosters of bebop when that came down the line. And then there was kind of a feeling on the part of the players whom he already knew and who now suddenly represented an older style that he had betrayed them. He was no longer the Leonard Feather they used to know. And this is a delicate situation. So through the years, Leonard has had a lot of problems in that respect, also because he was so powerful. He had a national radio program, he was a big-time producer and all that. Other people have gone into jazz, made a name for themselves, Nat Hentoff, for instance, and then left it because they had other interests and they couldn't make a living anyway. And Nat was always interested in politics and social issues, so he got into that. Now he's come back and he's writing about jazz again. I don't want to seem cold about it, but in part because there's a market. For a while there was no market.
He's the kind of person who can write a column that's a very eclectic column and frequently write about jazz within it, which also exposes jazz to an audience that might not ordinarily
Oh, yes, absolutely. No, he has managed to bring jazz in a lot into the other things and it's done well that way. And I'm not saying that it's not against him at all. It's simply not possible for most of us to do that. I'm not making a living as a writer now. If I had to, and on occasion I've had to, it's been a scuffle.
Mm-hmm. Well, listen, let's listen to another record that you've brought with you. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dan Morgenstern, and he is now the director of the Institute of Jazz Studies of Rutgers University in New Jersey. And I've asked him to bring with him today, which he has, some of the records from the archives of the Institute. And this next one is one by Billie Holiday.
Yeah, this is these records that Billie made in the 30s with Lester Young and Buck Clayton and guys from the Basie Band and other great players, Teddy Wilson, who of course was the musical director on most of them. These are unique records, and I've these records have been part of my life for as long as I can remember. And I've never gotten tired of them. You can listen to these things again and again, and they do not lose their appeal. They have a special something. Of course, the relationship between Billy and Lester, that was something very special, too. Anyway, they're together on this, and the trumpeter is Buck Clayton, the pianist Teddy Wilson, the rhythm section is from the Basie Band, the great all-American rhythm section of Freddie Green on guitar, Walter Page on bass, and Jill Jones on drums. This is a tune that was done, by the way, at the recent Newport Jazz Festival in the Black Broadway show, which was a very good show, where it was sung by Adelaide Hall, who introduced it in a show called, I believe, Blackbirds of 1928. And then Ethel Waters picked it up and made it famous. And then Billy, who admired Ethel in many ways, but was chiefly influenced by Bessie Smith and Louis Armstrong, did it in 1937, and it's called I Must Have That Man.
Don't want my mammy, I don't need a friend. My heart is broken, it won't ever mend. I ain't much caring just where I will end. I must have that man. I'm like an oven that's crying for heat. He treats me awful each time that we meet. It's just unlawful how that boy can cheat. But I must have that man. His heart is Hades. A lady's not safe in his arms when she's kissed. But I'm afraid that he's cooled off, and maybe I'm ruled off his list. I'll never be missed. I need that person much worse than just bad. I'm half alive and it's driving me mad. He's only human if had. I must have that
Holiday's recording of I Must Have That Man. This is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. My guest on Fresh Air now is Dan Morgenstern. We're listening to some of the records that he's brought with him, records that have been very important to him. And we're talking about some of the work that he's done within jazz. He's done a lot of writing about jazz. He's produced a lot of concerts. He's currently the director of the Institute of Jazz Studies, which is part of Rutgers University. Well, we were talking a little bit about your reactions to jazz criticism and jazz critics. Let's talk about another aspect of your work within jazz, and that's concert production, which involves a very different kind of relationship to both jazz musicians and to the jazz public. Because once you're a concert producer, then you really want to make an affirmative statement. I mean, you need to convince people at this point that they want to buy tickets to this. This is not about critical evaluations and about really judging the playing of somebody. How'd you get involved with that?
It makes you aware of, you know, it's another dimension of the music, and it also puts you in touch with some of the problems that musicians have in their working lives, which is very good for a writer. I got involved in it, parenthetically, I should mention that the clarinet on that Billie Holiday record was played by Benny Goodman, who is a guy who takes a lot of lumps here and there, but it's a fine clarinet player. Anyway, I got involved through my association with Metronome. Well, as a matter of fact, just before that, I had gotten my feet wet for the first time, and literally, because we took a bath and it was on Fire Island. It was billed as the first Fire Island Jazz Festival, and it was a situation I came into where I had to take over for someone who had been barred from the island for reasons that shall remain unmentioned, and therefore, it was already set, but not completely. There were certain people who had already been approached and hired, and I was able to add some others, but I had no real control over other elements of the situation. Anyway, it was a marvelous baptism of fire because this was in 1958, and we had Coleman Hawkins, Roy Eldridge, Dickie Wells, Ray Bryant, his brother Tommy on bass, and Eddie Locke on drums, and Maxine Sullivan as a guest artist, and then Tiger Haynes, who was working on the island then, he was working at some other place. He'd gotten wind of this, and he came over with his guitar and sang some blues. And it was a great musical event, but one thing that hadn't been considered was that this was in a restaurant on Ocean Beach, and it was a restaurant that had sort of like a porch, and of course in Fire Island it gets it's nice to, everything is open now, so the windows were open. It was an immensely hot night. As a matter of fact, after the first number, the musicians decided to strip down to their undershirts, which they did, and the Coleman Hawkins led off. He just took off his jacket, and he took off his tie, and he took off his shirt, and bam, there it was. It was the only thing to do. But there were 200 people inside and about 600 people outside on the beach because they could hear very nicely, and why should they pay their $3 to come in? And then later on, with Metronome, Bill Koss, who had been the predecessor of the new editor who came in with me, Dave Solomon, a somewhat notorious character, he had started an association with the Museum of Modern Art, presenting a series of summer concerts in the garden there, which is the sculpture garden, which is a perfect setting. And so once again, I stepped into a situation where I didn't have to contribute the groundwork, but it was an immensely satisfying thing to run these concerts, first for two seasons. When Metronome folded, we managed to form some kind of alliance with something called the United Nations Jazz Society, which a friend of mine who worked at the UN was president of, because the Museum of Modern Art was deathly afraid of putting their imprimatur on anything with having to do with jazz without having some other authority, that symbol that they could rely on. They were, frankly, not the greatest people in the world to work with. But in any case, after those two seasons, they were remodeling the garden, so it was closed for 2 years. And then we started again. By then I was with Downbeat, so that made a good safe sponsor, co-sponsor for the museum. And I ran, all told, I think, four or five seasons of concerts there. And it was ideal because they were at a time where you could hire somebody who had a gig that night. So if, say, Lee Konitz was in town, or Rahsaan Roland Kirk, or whoever it might be, with the permission of the club owners, didn't mind because it was publicity for them. They could play, and which was scheduled as an hour concert, but with encores, it usually ran an hour and 15 minutes outdoors and a beautiful setting. We were very lucky with the weather. It didn't rain too often.
When someone's producing a record, usually they have a certain quality control role within that recording session. They make judgments about what the right take should, you know, what take should be used, try to create a certain environment that seems really conducive for the musicians to be playing within. As someone who produced concerts, was there a certain environment you tried to create or a certain atmosphere for the musicians you tried to create to induce good playing?
The first thing is always to make sure that the musicians are comfortable with the situation, that there are no questions about the money or anything like that. All that is straight in front, that they have a chance to check out the physical aspects of the playing situation. What I tried to do at the museum was to get musicians who were scheduled to play there and who had never been there to come and attend the concert, which was great preparation for them because then they could get an idea of what the whole ambiance was like. Also, if they had some questions about the sound or the way the band was set up, we could arrange that to their liking. The sound wasn't always ideal because, again, the museum didn't want to spend a lot of money on a good sound system, but within the means at my disposal, we managed to do as good a job as we could. And we also had fun putting bands together. For instance, if I wanted to hire, say, Jackie Byer to do a concert, I would ask Jackie who he'd want to play with him and not say, you know, I want you to get so-and-so and so-and-so. So we had a nice situation there. Several of the things were recorded. Ironically, two of them never came out. One, I don't know why, that was a nice Art Farmer Benny Golson concert, but when the record came out, it was ostensibly, the liner notes are very cagey about it. It was ostensibly done at the museum, but it was really a studio date. So I imagine that the quality, sound quality, wasn't good enough. The other was a Sonny Rollins album, which was not released until last year, and which Sonny was upset about, I think mainly because he felt that he should have gotten paid more for it and that he should have been consulted about it. But unfortunately, it was one of those situations where at the time he was a contract artist. He had been paid for the session. This had nothing to do with me. I mean, we record companies were welcome to come in and record, but they couldn't control anything artistically about the situation. So another was released was Milt Jackson on Limelight. That was a nice session. And the Armed Forces Radio taped a lot of these things for broadcast overseas. And it was fun to do. It certainly was.
I know one concert that you produced that was very important to you and also important to Earl Hines was a concert in which I guess he really came back into the public eye again. Can you tell us a little bit about that concert, and then we'll hear a recording with him?
Yeah, gladly. That was in 1964 in March, and a friend of mine and I had found a backer who had known something or had some interest in the Little Theater, which is a beautiful, literally, little theater on West 44th Street in the Broadway area in New York, with marvelous acoustics. It holds about 350 people, and it's really like a miniature theater. And it had been used as a legitimate theater in the 20s, and then it became a broadcasting studio, I think, for ABC. And then at that point, it was at Liberty. And so it was empty, and the people who owned it were willing to, you know, take some kind of an investment risk. And so we persuaded them to put on a series called Jazz on Broadway. And we were really ahead of our times, and had a lot of good people, but except for the Earl Hines, none of them drew, so the series was cut short before it had a chance to conclude. Our last scheduled artist was Muddy Waters, who at that time had never appeared in this kind of a setting in New York, and it would have been smashed. We already had advanced sales for that, but, you know, at that point, again, the backers pulled out. But we did have a chance to do Lucky Thompson. We did Randy Weston. We did Coleman Hawkins and Ben Webster, which was a marvelous concert. Lost money, but it was a good concert. And then we did Earl Hines. And the Earl Hines one was a smash. And we had done this because we had felt that Earl Hines was a pianist whom we both admired and who, needless to say, had a great influence on the history of jazz piano and jazz in general. And he was kind of in limbo. Earl was never out of work. He was always active. And at that time, he'd been for many years working out of San Francisco mostly, and he'd been at a place called The Hangover with a kind of traditional band with Muggsy Spanier and Pops Foster and other people. That wasn't really his element. And from time to time he would come out. The year before he'd been at Birdland with a group that included an organ player and several singers, and it was very desultory and just very disappointing. And we felt that since he had just recently made a brilliant record produced by Stanley Dance, on which he showed that he was playing as well as he ever did, that here was somebody who should be brought to New York and who should have a chance to play the piano, which is what he did best. But Earl was a lifelong band leader, and he'd worked at the Grand Terrace in Chicago for years, where they had stage shows, and he was the conductor of all, and had singers and dancers, and he always felt a need to surround himself with all this stuff, which he does to this day. So when we first approached him, he said, "I'm not a solo pianist. I can't," in essence, he said, "I can't sustain anything like that." And we said, "What are you talking about? You're the greatest." So anyway, we managed to convince him, but only that he wanted a rhythm section, and he wanted, at least he would have preferred more, but he wanted one guest artist. So he suggested Bud Johnson, and that was fine with us. Bud, of course, a wonderful saxophonist who had been with him for many years when he had a big band. And we got Oliver Jackson and Ahmed Abdul-Malik for the rhythm section. And Earl arrived. We scheduled three concerts. I think it was one on a Friday night and then two on a Saturday, including a midnight concert. And the first one, well, people, of course, one thing I can say about my fellow critics, I mean, the ones who are established ones, at least they know their jazz history well enough to know that when Earl Hines appeared in New York, there was something they had to come to. So John Wilson came and Whitney Balliet came and number of others. Wilson wrote a rave in the Times, so the next day, at that time they were still writing, you know, that night, so the next day we were sold out for both concerts, and somebody, Mort Figa, a disc jockey, who was then very active in New York, a good jazz disc jockey, he had been at the first concert, and he said to my partner, he said, "We have to record this, we've got to record this." So we managed to arrange a recording of the last concert, the Saturday midnight one. It almost didn't happen because the engineer who was bringing his own equipment got stuck in traffic. He was coming in from Long Island. We held the concert for 15 minutes, and he did arrive, and we got set up. And it was recorded on Mort's own label, which was then, as he had a subsidiary relationship with Atlantic Records. It's long out of print. It was a label called Focus, and it captured some, I would say ideally all three concerts should have been recorded, and the best thing should have been picked from all of them, but under the circumstances it came out very nicely. The sound is not the greatest, but Earl was in wonderful shape, and shall I go ahead and introduce
it? Yeah, let's hear it.
It's Earl would start these concerts with a couple of unaccompanied solos, and one of the pieces he'd chosen is an old classic from the 20s in which he does a wonderful job. It's called "I Ain't Got Nobody." Thank you.
Earl Hines at the piano, I Ain't Got Nobody, in a concert that was produced by my guest Dan Morgenstern, who's joining us this afternoon from the Institute of Jazz Studies, where he is the director. That's part of Rutgers University and is located in New Jersey. Let's talk a little bit about the Institute, Jan. Let's hear about how it got formed. I know I was under the impression that the Institute was also a place that held classes, and it's not really. It's more of an archival function that the Institute serves. What kinds of information do you have there?
Well, all kinds, anything you can think of relating to jazz. The core of the collection, I guess, since we are dealing with music, which is primarily or exclusively documented through recordings, is the record collection, which is very large and constantly growing, I'm happy to say. We have around 35,078s and upward of 14,000-15,000 LPs. And while we do not have everything, we aim someday to have everything. We also have tapes and private recordings and some videotape, a little bit of film. I hope to build that up a bit more. Then we have the research components. We have books, practically every book ever published on jazz in any language. Again, not everything. There are some extremely rare and ephemeral things that we don't have. A big collection of periodicals. We have complete downbeats, the earliest ones, if any of you have ever seen those. They were done on a cheap kind of newsprint, and they're from 1934 and 1935, and they're crumbling. They do exist on microfilm, and we will get them, and we hope to be able to preserve the originals in some manner. We also have research files. That's something unique to the Institute. We have two basic components. We have a set of alphabetical files for the artists and other people involved in the music, a name file, and This will contain newspaper clippings, magazine articles, promotional materials, sometimes personal memorabilia, letters, cards, flyers, and things from that they used to put on the table in nightclubs, no, things like that. And I want to tell everybody about this. Save all those things. If you go to a concert and there is a flyer, save it. You'd be amazed. 20 years from now, that thing is going to be an artifact and a collector's item. You may not be able to make a lot of money on it, but if you save all these things, you can give them to the Institute 20 years from now, and we'll be pleased to get them. We also have photographs. And then the other component files is a topics file where you can look up things by category. We may have a heading of jazz festivals, and there you can look for all kinds of materials on all the Newport festivals and other things, European festivals and so on. We may have a category like jazz dance, and under that you'll find a file on ballrooms, and there you'll find clippings about the Savoy Ballroom in Harlem and other famous places like that. And topics like, for instance, women in jazz, and a variety of things. This is extremely useful to researchers. And to back this up, of course, they're the periodicals. Unfortunately, many of those are not indexed. Downbeat began to index only in 1960. And there's a real need for someone or a number of people in the field, librarians and people like that, who make up indexes and bibliographies to get to jazz. And we have discographies, of course, every discography that we can put our hands on. Naturally, the main ones like Brian Rust's Jazz Records, 1898 to 1942, and the Jepson, which takes up where Rust leaves off, and special named discographies, a particular artist or a particular label.
Who has access to the collections that you have?
Everyone with a legitimate purpose of consulting it. We are, in a sense, if we were library people, we would think of ourselves or be thought of as what they call a rare book collection, something which in some cases in many libraries is extremely restricted because we do have a lot of rare materials. However, our feeling is that the purpose of the Institute is to serve the field, and we define that very broadly. So it's by no means only academics with credentials who have access. We do get a lot of those, people who are teaching jazz, people who are writing about it. But we also get a legitimate collector, someone who is, in the best sense of the word, an amateur scholar, or a kid who's been assigned a term paper on a jazz figure and wants to look up something about John Coltrane or Ella Fitzgerald, or listen to the records. That's fine. All we require is advance notice, because we can't handle a lot of people at the same time. Then it, you know, it gets out of hand, and we can't give them the attention that they deserve. We also respond to mail inquiries or telephone queries. Those we get from all over the place, including the media. When Mingus died, CBS TV came to us because they wanted to do a piece, so we got some stuff together for them, and they were very grateful, and we're happy to do that sort of thing. We work with record companies who need source materials that they don't have anymore, or which we might have in better condition than they do. We work currently with Time Life and their series, doing a lot of research for them and so on. And that also, of course, provides some income for the Institute, although people who come in to do research are not charged anything. If they want materials within the restrictions of the copyright law, we can Xerox things for them or tape things for them, provided they're out of print and in the clear, and it's only for their personal use. So over the years, I've been there for 3 years now, and awareness of the Institute is beginning to grow, and we've had the good fortune that we currently have a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities to do a cataloging project, which we hope to be able to continue so we can catalog the entire collection. But it's computerized cataloging, which is what most libraries are into now, and all university libraries are. There are networks of computers, and everything is now cataloged, not by hand, but in the computer. And it offers a lot of great advantages, and in terms of jazz recordings, which have been very poorly cataloged by libraries because they've been cataloged on the model of books, and they're not books. They're different kinds of documents. And especially in jazz or other performance, performer-oriented musics, to have the composer doesn't do you any good. I mean, if you're looking for a recording of I Got Rhythm by Coleman Hawkins, you don't want to look in the Gershwin and find 900 entries for I Got Rhythm. You know, you want that one with Coleman Hawkins. So it's an interesting project, and we are hard at work on it, and we hope that we will get further funding for that. We're also very interested in oral history, and we hope that we will soon have a major oral history project going, too. So everything is on the upswing. It's very rewarding, and it's very exciting work, really. I mean, you think of archives and research as something being very dry, but it's actually a lot of fun, and it's nice to be able to help people. And it's on all levels, like maybe a filmmaker who is doing something related to jazz. And whatever, it keeps you in touch with all areas of the field.
Some of our listeners may also know about the Livingston College, which is a college that has a very excellent jazz program, which is also part of Rutgers University. And I know that they've done a lot of open to the public concert performances, like the work of Ted Dameron. There was a concert, I think, dedicated to Charles Mingus after his death. The works of Bud Powell have been performed. What's your relationship to the jazz program at Livingston College?
Well, naturally, we're both part of Rutgers, and we work very closely. Larry Ridley, who is the chairman of the music department at Livingston, sits on the institute board, and in the concert series, we work together on that under a grant from the National Endowment for the Arts. And usually when there is a theme concert like that, we had that great jazz composers thing, the institute prepares an introductory statement about the artist, a biography and so on, which usually I or a member of my staff will present before the concert. And we also help with the publicity efforts and other things like that. And on a more day-to-day basis, we provide materials for the courses at Livingston. And for instance, Ted Dunbar, who teaches guitar, may ask us to put together a history of jazz guitar on tape that he can use for his students. Paul Jeffrey, who is now running the ensemble at Livingston, which he has made into a really first-rate college jazz group, recently asked us for a minor thing, to put all of Lester Young, all of Sonny Rollins, and all of John Coltrane on tape for him. That'll keep us busy
small
for
project,
a while.
Yeah.
But again, I mean, this is something that we're pleased to do, and
The Institute is in Newark, New Jersey, which means that we residents of the Delaware Valley do have fairly easy access to it for research purposes. Would it be possible, Dan, for you to tell us what the phone number is in case anyone wants to get in touch with the Institute for research?
Be delighted. It's area code 201-648-5595. That's 648-5595. And we're open weekdays. We're not open on weekends, but we're open all through the summer. We do not close for the academic calendar. We're always there, except, of course, on the 4th of July or Christmas time. But someone will be there to answer your call, and we will do our best to help. And if you want to come and do some research on the premises or consult anything in the archives and so on, just let us know when you want to come, and we'll set up an appointment. And I think you'll get a kick out of it. It's a unique place.
Really. Well, listen, let's listen to another one of the recordings that you've brought with you. And this next one is a pretty new one.
Yeah, well, I thought I don't want to seem to be living in the past. Of course, Earl Hines is still very active, God bless him. And so is this gentleman. I think this is a man who, because of his activities as a band leader, composer, and arranger, has been somewhat neglected as a player, and in part it's his own fault, although I don't blame him in the least. But Thad Jones, when he co-led his big band with Mel Lewis, did not feature himself extensively as a soloist, and there's a good reason for that, because you want to keep up morale in the band, and a leader who hogs all the solo space soon becomes unpopular with his sidemen. But we don't have a chance to hear as much of Thad Jones as we would like. But recently, he and Mel made a quartet record with the support of the then pianist and bassist in the band, Harold Danko on piano and Rufus Reed on bass. And it's a delightful record, and it really shows some of what Thad Jones can do. I think he's one of the most original and creative trumpet players in modern jazz, someone who took something from the great Dizzy Gillespie that he turned into something very special. Dizzy has a fantastic ear, and many of the other trumpet players who copied certain things of Dizzy never really got close to him harmonically. Thad did, and then he added some of his own things to that, and of course he has his own sound and his own approach to the horn. Anyway, this is something which is based on a standard, and it's so obvious that I wouldn't even have to tell you, because you will know it from the title, which only lacks two words to complete it. They call it, "What Is This Thing?" Thank you.
And Thad Jones on trumpet. That's from an album that Dan Morgenstern has brought with him this afternoon. Dan, you were telling us about the archives at the Institute of Jazz Studies, and you have, I think you said, 35,078. Now, that's an extraordinary amount of music. And you probably have a lot of stuff in your archives that the record companies have locked up in their vaults. It's an interesting thing, but most of the history of jazz is not around anymore. Because most of it, aside from what the collectors have and what the archives have, is long out of print and remains in the vault of record companies. And lately, many record companies have started reissue programs. Some of them have continued. Some of them have kind of stopped almost as soon as they got started. I'm wondering how you feel about the record company's responsibilities to make the music accessible. Do you think that the record company should have a responsibility to do that?
Absolutely. They are charged with the responsibility to keep this music alive, so to speak, to keep it available, because it is a cultural document of the highest importance. This is America's own unique music, and America's, in some senses, I'm not one of those who will blow the horn for jazz at the exclusion of everything else. America has produced a lot of great art, fortunately. But jazz is unique, and it's uniquely American, even though it's played all over the world. And it is a shame when you have to go to Japan, or to France, or to England, or to Germany, to find recordings of American music by American artists, which is available there and beautifully produced and unavailable here. And the record companies have the rights to this material. They will not, except in the very rare circumstances, lease it to anyone else who might want to issue it. They're not doing it themselves in any systematic way. And the reason for that is that because of cultural myopia and prejudice, they do not feel the same kind of commitment to jazz or to the blues or other American vernacular musics that they feel to European classical music in the Western tradition. I don't have to tell you how many, never at any time since the phonograph came of age, which was much longer ago than most people think. Beethoven's Fifth was recorded for the first time, I think, in 1909. It wasn't in very good sound, certainly wasn't stereo, but there it was, and it has never been out of the catalog since. And you can go into any record store and find dozens of versions of Beethoven's Fifth, and each year new ones come out, sometimes by the same conductors with other orchestras. Lord knows how many times some conductors have recorded that piece, or anything else in the standard repertoire. To this they feel a commitment. They lose money on it, but they do it all the time, because it is culturally prestigious. But to do jazz, unfortunately, is not, or they don't think it is. And therefore, jazz always becomes a stepchild, so that whereas you have in France a collection of Duke Ellington's complete recorded works on RCA Victor, those that belong to that label, and there's an enormous amount, which has now reached the 22 volumes, whereas RCA in this country has available a pitiful amount. Fortunately, the Smithsonian Institution, which is doing a fine reissue project, is putting Ellington from 1938, 39, 1940, which is perhaps the greatest period of the band, back on the market. But the company is doing nothing.
Well, it's an interesting problem here, because companies, like record companies and like most corporations, exist first and foremost to make a profit. That's usually the way they define their goals, and very few companies, I think, would, when it comes down to it, really define their goals as keeping America's cultural life alive and available. However, here are the record companies with the ability to either make available these records or not make them available. And it's easy to understand how if they didn't see it as being profitable, they wouldn't bother investing their time and money in it. But is it forgivable? Well, that's a different question.
Well, the joke is that it is profitable, but it's profitable in the long run. For instance, Columbia, which has by and large done a much better job than RCA, if you're going to talk about the giants, or Decca, which is now MCA, companies that really have substantial holdings of jazz going all the way back to the beginnings of recorded jazz. Columbia has done a decent job. Now, you show me any other instance in the world of sound recordings since the advent of LP of a set of records never having gone out of circulation since the early 50s. Well, there, Columbia has the Louis Armstrong story, 4 volumes. It is not complete. There are only 6 tracks to a side because it was done at a time when that was all you were able to get on or thought you were able to get on. It has not really been remastered. But there it is. It's been in the catalog since 1954. It's still selling. And I bet you if you added up the number of records that have been sold, which didn't cost the company a penny except to master and press and print covers and pay the liner note writers, which they did, you know, more than 20 years ago. I'm sure they realized a nice little nest egg from that, but they think only in terms of quick profits. It's an industry that's oriented, like everything, unfortunately, in this economy, to quick profits. And everything is rendered obsolete immediately. You want to sell 1 million copies of some contemporary thing, which then disappears and sinks like a stone to the bottom of the ocean. And you do not want to make a modest investment in something that will remain in the catalog in all perpetuity for all practical purposes. It's stupid.
Well, let's listen to another record you've brought with you. And if I'm not mistaken, this is an example of something that is out of print.
It's a perfect example. It's a beautiful recording. The whole album is very good. This is the masterpiece on it. It was done in 1953 for Capitol Records. And it features a great baritone saxophonist, I think one of the 2 greatest baritone saxophonists in the history of jazz. The other one was Harry Carney. This is Serge Chaloff, who unfortunately had a tragically brief career, but managed to set down some very memorable things. Now, this record is available in Japan in a beautifully pressed and remastered version, but it's been unavailable in this country since it went out of print around 1955 or so. It's a classic. I spent years, before it came out in Japan, I spent years trying to find a decent copy of this. I eventually did, and it cost me something like $20. Now it would probably cost $50. There's quite a market among collectors in this, which also indicates how short-sighted the record companies are. Anyway, this is Serge Chaloff at his memorable best in a beautiful version of Body and Soul. Thank you.
Serge Chaloff's recording of Body and Soul. My guest is Dan Morgenstern, and we're talking about some of his work at the Institute of Jazz Studies, of which he is the director, and we've also been discussing some of his work as a concert producer, some of the things he's written about jazz. I'd like to continue talking a little bit about record companies and records. One of the, given that the record companies have all this stuff in their vaults, which most people don't have access to, one way around that is to try to find people's 78s or albums of these from when they were originally issued and bootleg them, do a bootleg reissue. And there's some very interesting arguments for and against that kind of approach. The argument for is an obvious one. It's the only way the music's going to become accessible again unless the companies decide to re-release it. The argument against it is that the musicians have no input into it. They're usually not informed in a bootleg. The people who might make money if their work was reissued certainly wouldn't if the album was bootlegged. You could also argue that the recording quality of the bootleg might not really do justice to the recording, since bootlegs are usually operate with a lot cheaper facilities than the record companies do. What do you think of both sides here? Where do you stand on the question of bootleg recordings?
Well, it's a very complicated question. On the one hand, certainly I stand firmly opposed to ripping off the artist, and that is unfortunately what's very often involved. On the other hand, we have to distinguish between unauthorized re-releases of materials that belongs to a record company which neglects it and shows no interest in or no indication of ever issuing this material. And these kind of things, if they are recordings that were made under a contractual agreement with a record company at any given time, which specified that the record company retained rights in perpetuity to re-release this material, then if the record company were to issue it legitimately, the artist would very often get nothing and would not be consulted. He would get something if he were a composer, because of course they pay mechanical royalties. He would not necessarily get anything at all for the other aspects of his work, because that belongs. In the old days, artists, even contract artists, were paid outright on a per-side basis. If they were doing well, they got $100 a side. If they were not doing well, $25. That was it. For that, they signed away all their rights. Now, some record companies, I must say, have shown a nice sense of fairness, mostly due to the efforts of people like John Hammond when he was a vice president at Columbia, and when they reissued Ethel Waters' material, he saw to it that Miss Waters got a few $1,000s, at least when those albums were brought out. Normally, if he hadn't been there, they wouldn't have done that because they were not obligated to do so. So those types of reissues, especially when they're done with small labels, with a small circulation, and in some cases really done by, I must say, people who in a strange way are dedicated and who do not realize anything from this, because what they do is they take the money that they make on one record and put it into the next one. And very often it's really a shoestring operation, and they only do it because they have a certain kind of perhaps misguided commitment to the music. They don't think of it in terms of the artist and his problem. They think of it as something which exists sort of in space, and they're capturing it and, you know, retaining it. The more serious problem is the material that was never recorded for commercial purposes and for which the musicians never got paid. And there's been a tremendous proliferation of this.